In this episode, I'm joined by Dalraj Nijjar from Concrete for Change. Dalraj is the co-founder and chief commercial officer, I understand, of this, what is going to be, and when you hear the story and you hear how and why this is created, it is a phenomenal story. And to be chief commercial officer of an entity like this, one, I'm guessing, and we're going to hear, is really exciting, but two, also comes with quite some level of responsibility, because the amount of potential change that is going to be coming as a byproduct of what Dalraj is focusing on here could literally change the world. So without further ado, a little bit of backstory, Dalraj. I mean, let's kind of hear kind of how you got, because it was quite an interesting route, wasn't it? It wasn't necessarily a traditional route to kind of where you are sat right here today.
Yeah, very much so. First of all, thank you for having me, Neil. Pleasure to be here and speak with you and your audience. In terms of background, so I guess I'm a newbie to construction, actually, newbie to concrete. I'd be lying if I said I envisioned myself working in the concrete industry if I was to think about that 5 or 10 years ago. But I guess here we are today. So prior to Concrete for Change forming, I worked at the University of Warwick, specifically Warwick Manufacturing Group, which is one of the biggest departments there. And I was one of the founding members of the Startup Accelerator Group there at WMG. And a lot of our work there focused on helping companies who are also developing quite innovative climate tech solutions in a range of different industries. And then my role in particular in that accelerator was trying to help those companies from a commercial perspective, really try to identify where problems lied in their particular industry vertical and how they can find real product market fit, really solve things in an innovative way and create, you know, real defensibility and a path to scaling up. So I guess that's really, that piece of work has really, really helped me in terms of growing my own profile from a personal perspective, but also working with a number of companies in this kind of wider climate technology space to really get an understanding of how to really pinpoint and solve certain challenges really, really well and doing it in a good way. So that working there actually led me to be introduced to the two other co-founders of Concrete for Change. So naturally, when you're, I guess, any startup accelerator, you get exposed to the wider startup ecosystem, founders, investors, you know, even corporates as well, if you want to get involved. So through that mechanism, I got to know Sid and Michael, who are two co-founders as well. And just from there, at that point with which I met them in particular, I was looking to go into a startup actually, and go into it full time. I kind of had that itch to join a company and really go full steam ahead. And I was just really fascinated by the idea that they had, the technical idea that they had. And my commercial profile really fitted in well with their technical skill sets and created a good, I guess, harmony from that sense. I could really feel some gaps from a commercial perspective that they needed at that time. So that's how I came to know them. And then just quickly on the previous background. So I grew up in the Midlands. So I'm from Coventry. I've been working in, I guess, family businesses for basically all my childhood. So my dad had a number of hospitality and retail businesses, which I was involved in pretty much all the time. So I had a grounding in kind of like entrepreneurship, you know, small business from a very early age. So it's kind of almost hardwired into me to some extent, and created a good work ethic, I'd like to think, as well. And then studied entrepreneurship at university, at Loughborough University, and had a number of corporate roles as well. Worked at IBM for a period of time after graduating. And I've since then been involved in this kind of startup ecosystem or entrepreneurship space for basically the last six or seven years now since graduating. So, and during that period of 6 or 7 years, I've really been interested in climate technologies and obviously the problem of climate change that we face, because I truly believe this next decade is the decade of climate tech, where really interesting solutions can come to the fore and create some really significant positive change, not just from an entrepreneurial perspective, but in terms of wider global societal benefits as well, energy security, creating new ways of working, new ecosystems. It's got so much potential to change how we live, and hopefully Concrete for Change could be a very small part of that in the future in the concrete industry. yeah, I hope that gives some good context.
It does. It really does. And I guess for me, it touches on sort of a number of different, you know, really important elements of this mix, because, you know, anybody, I guess, can come up with a brainwave of an idea, but having, as you've described it, that kind of ecosystem of connections, having, you know, the entrepreneurial kind of, I guess, confidence to really kind of take it to the next stage. I mean, so many people have dreams and then never realize those dreams because they either don't have the support or there isn't the perceived skill set, or, you know, there's 101 reasons why things don't happen. But I guess you were kind of, and I suppose it's serendipity, isn't it, really? I mean, you were kind of in the right place at the right time with the right skill set and the desire and the kind of knowledge of the how to, but also who to with. And I suppose it is this almost this magical mix of, you have to know the right people, because even if it was your idea, or if even if you just, you know, have this amazing kind of sort of concept, it's almost you have to surround yourself with those who can sort of infill to make that innovation or just that idea happen. Because, you know, I'm sure loads of people fall at that first hurdle because they just tried it too hard to do everything. I mean, have you found these kind of collaborative skills as being one of those big accelerators, really, as part of this process?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I think I'm a big believer in execution over ideas. Everybody has great ideas, and you can find them in any space, any corner of whichever, I guess, area you're looking into. But fundamentally, it's about how we can put them into place and how we can implement them, how we can bring them to life. And that then requires what I like to think is a good team of people who have different parts or different skill sets that can solve the puzzle in front of you. I'm a more commercially focused person, as you said from the outset, so that's my domain, but I still need to have a good understanding of how technology works, why it works, how it works, how it differentiates from other things on the market, what step change it provides, because then I can then translate that and make it accessible to everybody, and turn that into commercial value for not just ourselves, but, you know, any companies or partners that we might be working with. So yeah, I think particularly in startups as well, you really need a good team of people who really complement each other, who you can get along with as well, because there's lots of fires to fight. Lots of things can go wrong and will go wrong, and how you react to that is very important. And working very collaboratively is very important as well, because there may be certain things that I'm not so aware of doing or may not have such a grounding in, which requires someone else to maybe step in and do a part of that, and vice versa. So being very fluid and working in that kind of collaborative way is really, really important. And particularly in our, I guess, thinking about startups and new technologies, you know, even the best entrepreneurs that you can think of, they don't do it alone. They have a team of really, really smart people behind them executing on their vision. Obviously, initially, that entrepreneur, or, you know, that core team was, you know, one of however many people, but eventually, hopefully, if that idea or if that purpose grows and the idea takes off, naturally, you need more people to support it and grow it over time. And I guess finding those right people is a challenge, but also kind of instilling those values in them that you put in from the outset is also can be a challenge. But having said that, there's lots of great people out there. I'm a big believer in that. There's so many talented people out there who may or may not have had the opportunity to express that talent, and it may be hidden in there, but if we can extract it, then they can showcase how great they are. It's very much a team game. It's very much, I'm a big believer in that. I actually, in a weird way, I don't even think I'm an entrepreneur, weirdly enough. I think I'm an entrepreneurial person, but I think there's a reason why I'm not the CEO. I'm not the number one, but I see myself as maybe in the future, but maybe right now I think I'm more suited to, let's say, number two or number three role, for example, because I have a good understanding to this point of what I'm good at, what maybe I'm not so good at, and how that interacts with my colleagues, and what we're trying to focus on, trying to build, is important. And doing it and working collaboratively and working as a team towards an objective is important. So that's kind of my holistic way of looking at it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And I think it is this playing to skill sets. And I think we've kind of in various ways described it already sort of three or four times between us here. But I think it is about playing to, Yeah, kind of the strengths, really, because it's a hard space. I mean, whether it's climate tech, whether it's fintech, whether it's, you know, pharmaceutical kind of innovation, whichever kind of industry or sector or vertical you're looking at here, these are hard spaces to play in, even for the big boys, you know, where you've got a very well-established organization to the level of even corporate, and they've got big budgets and stuff. It's still very, very hard to differentiate between what is just a good idea and what is going to be something that's absolutely groundbreaking. And the groundbreaking bit, we're going to come on to everybody in a moment. So I am going to get there. But I just want to just kind of, as we go there, because we are talking about this kind of entrepreneurial spirit, this kind of, you know, how to innovate and really have And somebody was talking to me recently and described it as a startup mindset. And I think there's something really healthy in that, because a lot of people are resistant to change. A lot of people enjoy the word normal, if there is such a thing. I think we've moved beyond normal. I don't think anything in this world is normal anymore. I mean, change is a constant. But people still find comfort in just the predictability of normal. Whereas entrepreneurial spirit, you're taking the risk. You've got the confidence to kind of challenge. You know that there's potential benefit in an innovation or in something being different or done differently to the way it's always been done. When that kind of comes through in an organization like yours, and we'll come on to the details and do a deeper dive into your amazing case study in a moment, but in an organization like yours, I guess there is a danger that you can almost get caught up in the mindset of, well, let's just almost keep all these cards to ourselves. Let's look for funding. Let's look for partnerships. Let's not share this as a commercial business, because actually there's a lot of funding out there for cool ideas. And because we can kind of showcase that it's a cool idea, but we've also got the experience to make this happen, we can just chase funding. So you might be going for Series A, Series B, Series C, and the list literally goes on. And then you never change the business, because all you are is a funding machine creator. I mean, I'm being a bit of a devil's advocate here, but how do you kind of, from a commercial sense, manage what is a great idea and bring it kind of to life commercially, rather than just be chasing the next round of funding?
Yeah, no, it's a good topic that you bring up. I think it's a case of completing certain milestones and truly justifying that you deserve that funding that you're looking to get, right? It's almost, particularly in the startup world, I guess for particularly high growth startups or companies that have the potential to scale to, you know, a very large company, a unicorn, if you will, is a term that's used. Typically venture capital is a means of which to do that or, you know, fund that potentiality. But having said that, venture capital is, the way I conceptualize it, is milestone-based financing. You know, you could have the greatest idea in the world on paper, but no one's going to give you £100 million for it, just for a piece of paper, right? So there's a reason why there's different stages of funding, so that you can test out your hypotheses at the different stages, prove out those assumptions, provide some data which justifies, you know, your approach and your belief in your idea, you know, in hard numbers or some, you know, some data or whichever evidence you have. And then your case for raising more money is that much better and that much clearer. And it's not just a case of just raising money for the sake of raising money, because based off your idea or based off the strength of your profile, et cetera, which we have seen in, I guess, in the last, I'd say, 5-10 years. Obviously, given more macro environment now, in terms of inflation and stuff like that, things are becoming a bit more pressurized, and even investors as well are becoming more conscious of where they're putting their money, as they always should be. But I think now in particular, that's becoming more of a concern. I think from a commercial perspective, it's about almost, you got to grow a little bit faster than what you are able to do, if that makes sense. You should be at the bleeding edge of servicing just enough demand as much as you can, and then raising enough money just to service that, but at the same time, that maximizes the resources that you have, if that makes sense. So you're not just over diluting or overfunding yourself just because you can. And a lot of the cases that's done, again, as I said, like you get certain entrepreneurs that have that gravitas that can do that, or, you know, you've got certain ideas which has, like, there's a certain level of pull to it because it's a hot topic at that moment or whatever the case may be. But I think if you can really showcase how you're maximizing your resources at that particular time, point in time of your company, then you're in a better place than say, okay, if you actually gave me some more money, then I can take this to the next level, because you've got that evidence to show there that, look, we're doing the maximum that we can and going above and beyond to deliver on our commercial, you know, milestones per se. And therefore, accelerating that with some more capital will have natural benefits that we can then take to the next level, right? So yeah, I'm a big believer in trying to squeeze as much as you can from whatever you have at first. And then through doing that, hopefully get enough results, which showcases that, look, people are willing to buy into your idea, we have customers or we have partners who are willing to invest in us, whatever the case may be. And therefore you're a more credible company as well, right? Funding is just one element. It of course is important. It's very, very important to have enough money to deliver on your vision, but at the same time, funding for funding's sake is neither here nor there. If anything, you just want to raise the right amount of money to complete the objective at hand, which is to, you know, bring your idea to life, make sure it works, make sure it's valuable in the market, make sure that it's defensible, and that will change. That may be a lot of money, that may be 10 plus million for one company, it might be £100,000 for another company. It's very, very much dependent. But it's up to that person or that team behind that idea or company to understand what that is and outline that vision and execute accordingly. So yeah, again, I hope that makes sense. But that's the way I tend to think about it.
Yeah, and I think it was really important for us to kind of get a sense of your ethos in the efficiencies, the practicality of this. You know, as we said at the outset, you know, there's loads of great ideas out there, but the difference between Concrete for Change and the journey that you guys are on versus a lot of people who are not making such great inroads, even though they might have equally great ideas, is a lot of this kind of commercial sensibility. So I thought it was really important that everybody understood that this is not just a great idea, it's a great idea, but actually there's a great business model and a great ethos behind it. Because I think also, yeah, I mean, that just then sort of shouts the sustainability of the business, not just of the actual product and the innovation and the vision. So yeah, it's interesting. And I'm very glad that we kind of went there. But I don't want to hold up this whole kind of showcasing of Concrete for Change, because we do need to go here now. So tell us a little bit about the kind of conceptually the idea, and then we'll go a little bit more into kind of how this is going to happen and what people are going to see it and kind of what you're going to be all doing and stuff in a moment. But what is the idea? What is Concrete for Change?
Yeah, so I guess to set context, so the problem with industry today, with the concrete industry, I should say, is that it contributes 8% of all global CO2 emissions. And in the worst case scenario, if business as usual was to be continued, the forecast is it will be 40% of the global allowance by 2050, which is obviously not great. And also, as well, in industry, there are a number of solutions in place whereby they're trying to reduce their embodied carbon. So one thing I should add is actually that the biggest reason for that 8% figure is the production of cement, which is roughly 7% of that 8% figure. So the process, the emissions from cement production is in process. So there's various initiatives to decarbonize cement production. Essentially half the emissions comes from the actual operations itself. So the furnaces and the fuels for those furnaces for the production of cement in particular. But actually the materials, the base materials used in cement production, in particular limestone, a couple of others, when you heat up those materials to such a high level, they actually liberate CO2 naturally. So no matter what you do in terms of decarbonizing the other elements, still that inherent emission is there within cement production, in cement making. So there are a number of, I guess, carbon-free cements being developed by other players, both large and small, but those are very, very much in nascent stages. And there's also the regulatory aspects as well with the building industry and concrete and cement. Regulation is not necessarily conducive to introducing new cements very quickly. It takes a very long time for new materials to come, new concretes and new cements to be approved. So that's just the context from an industry perspective. But then what's very interesting is concrete actually is, if done well, if done properly, is actually one of the safest and best forms of CO2 sink in the world. So if you, I guess everybody listening and ourselves, if you imagine where you're sitting right now, if it was a purely concrete structure, maybe it is for yourself wherever you are, over its, let's say, 100-year lifespan of that concrete structure, it can actually absorb carbon from the air in this process known as carbonation. So the concrete can naturally absorb CO2. This process of carbonation, especially in natural circumstances, is very, very limited. So you need very specific atmospheric conditions, very specific humidity, temperatures, for carbonation in the natural scenario to happen to its maximum potential. And also as well, there's a factor of most concrete structures, you know, large buildings, for example, they're usually covered, they're like screeds or, you know, decorations or fascias, for example. And that layer then prevents CO2 from the air reacting with concrete, so to speak. But that being said, the potential is there. And basically as well, with natural carbonation of existing concrete structures, the carbonation will only happen at the very first layers of concrete. So if you were to take a cross section of, let's say, the outermost layers, the carbonation only happen at the very first few millimeters. Basically, it won't penetrate all the way through. But again, as I say, the theory is there. And so there's been a decent body of research now that's been collated and put together by a number of universities. I think the main one, the main party was University of Michigan. They've been kind of leaders in kind of this thought leadership around carbonation. And so concrete can actually absorb 30% of its weight by the cement content in concrete by CO2. Now, if you were to do that, if you were to carbonate concrete to that amount, you'd basically solve the entire emission problem of the EU, plus a lot more. But no one's ever got close to that, not even scratched the surface. You know, we're all starting from very basically zero. But again, the theoretical possibility is there, which is quite exciting. And so that leads on to Concrete for Change. So what we're essentially doing is trying to harness this potential of concrete to absorb CO2 and lock it down forever. So that's one thing I probably should have said is a little bit earlier, is actually when you carbonate concrete, it actually stores CO2 forever. It will not leak. So even if you demolish concrete building, the CO2 that's in there through carbonation will not leak at all. You have to heat it up to 1,000 degrees for that CO2 to be liberated. And obviously that's not going to happen in real life circumstances. So carbonation is there. So what we're doing is essentially carbon sequestration for concrete. So carbon sequestration is fairly well established space now within concrete. There are a number of other companies, primarily from North America, who have their methods of doing carbon sequestration. But we believe we're developing something very, well, it's proven to be very novel and very evolutionary, or a big step change, and much more effective, and the potential to really get up to the maximum potential for concrete to absorb CO2 and lock it down for value. So with our process, it's still in development phase, I should say. We're not fully commercialized yet, but we're still we're confident that once we get over technical milestones, we'll be able to commercialize fully by 2025. And so our process is, we can take CO2 from any industry, essentially. So we could use, well, we have a particular focus on actually CO2 that's generated from cement production and captured from cement production. And then essentially we can then inject that inside of our carrier. Now, this carrier is essentially like a granular material, if you look at it. It looks like a powder-like material if you look at it in your hand. And essentially this is an adsorbent. So adsorbents are used in carbon capture at the moment, in carbon capture facilities. And these adsorbents in that vertical are typically used to capture CO2 quite quickly and then release it and then do that process over and over again over a long period of time. Whereas our adsorbent is essentially a single-use adsorbent. So we inject CO2 into the carrier. The carrier is then mixed with fresh concrete. And then basically the carrier will release that CO2 inside concrete, so much so that the CO2 that's released will mineralize within concrete, meaning it will basically lock down in concrete and be stored away forever. I guess for people who are more of a scientific or technical inclination, basically what happens in the first few hours of concrete curing, it's basically called the hydration phase, and the calcium from cement reacts with water that you mix with concrete in the initial phase. That creates calcium hydroxide. Now, when you introduce carbon into that equation, then you transfer that calcium hydroxide into calcium carbonate, and that's essentially like a synthetic limestone. But that secondary reaction of creating calcium carbonate actually increases concrete strength. And so when you increase concrete strength, that means actually you can reduce the amount of binder content, i.e. cement, needed in concrete. Because for most applications of concrete, you don't need the extra strength. The recipe is designed such a way that you're targeting a specific strength grade. So if you can go above and beyond that, therefore you can create, you can reduce the amount of cement needed to create equivalent strength concrete. So our technology is designed to lock down CO2 forever via CO2 injection. And then as a result of that, you can reduce the amount of CO2, cement needed in concrete. So there's CO2 avoided via lesser cement. And this is a methodology that's already verified in voluntary carbon markets as well, and well recognized in our space. So with our first generation of technology, what we're looking at is injecting up to 5% CO2 by the weight of cement via our carrier. And that can, we're aiming for that to create a 25% strength increase in concrete. And that will then enable a approximate 20% reduction in cement. So our concrete, or I guess concrete used with made with concrete changes technology, I should say, is going to be roughly 20% greener with our first generation. And then there are a number of commercial benefits from that, which will make it 35% cheaper, in particular carbon offsetting is a big part of that, and also material reduction. Cement is basically the most expensive material of concrete as well. It's only 10 to 12% of actually a concrete mix design, but it's around 70% of the cost and 80% of the emissions. So if you can reduce the amount of cement, there's obviously a direct cost and emission benefit. So that's what we're developing. We're still, as I said, we're still in the R&D phase, but we've completed proof of concept, which went successfully. We've had a number of tests and a large industrial trial with one of the UK's biggest concrete manufacturers. Two of our investors are actually two of the largest concrete manufacturers in the world as well, in fact. So we've got a number of, we've got great interest in further trials and further tests, which are in our pipeline that we want to complete in the next couple of years. And yeah, it's going well so far, I should say, but like with any deep material tech solution, there are a number of challenges and milestones that we need to complete over the next 2 to 3 years to really ensure that our technology works 100% of the time, all the time, because particularly in construction, it can't fail, right? It's a very conservative industry, very, how can I say, in a nice way, doesn't like innovating that much. They very much, you know, keep things as usual because that's what's known. They're confident and comfortable with that. So if you're introducing new ways of working, new solutions, new innovations, you have to have really strong bank of evidence to say, look, guys, this works. You know, this essentially we're creating, the concrete that you're using doesn't look any different. Essentially, it's the same, but it's just incorporating our additive, our carrier in there for numerous benefits. So yeah, I hope that's clear. I hope that's useful.
It is. Yeah, and it's interesting because listening to you talking here, for me, the difference between how you're describing this and a lot of the examples, I guess, that, you know, everybody listening and myself included and probably you as well, kind of see, almost have like one benefit. It's like you can see that it's either a commercial benefit or it's a benefit to planet or it's a benefit to society. It's just like there's one golden hook, whereas actually what you've described here is really quite fascinating because it feels like this is more of a formula of benefits here. There's a strength argument, there's a longevity argument, there's an efficiency argument, there's a process argument, there's a financial argument. Is this the big difference, do you feel, between Concrete for Change and I would say probably 95, if not even 98% of other great ideas that are in, you know, this sustainability kind of friendly field? Because it feels that a lot of those, they have the one hook, but they struggle because it doesn't necessarily apply or appease all stakeholders and all the challenges. Whereas actually what you're doing is you've got this kind of formula that what's not to like, because there's something in this for everybody, isn't there?
Yeah, very much so. I guess in our case, our hook is the carrier, if you will, is the material that we use to absorb and transfer and mineralize CO2. But that USP, if you will, that core innovation has a number of layered benefits. Obviously, the carbon save, the carbon removal aspects in terms of locking down CO2 and removing CO2, as well. But then there's a number of kind of almost derivative financial benefits as a result of doing that process, of completing that process. There's carbon offset markets, which I guess in the case of concrete, because concrete is one of the best forms of CO2 sink, as I said earlier, the offsets in these in that space, in the concrete space, are actually some of the most expensive because they're very, very high quality. In our case, we can actually verify and measure how much CO2 we're removing to the T, like a specific number, which, you know, other methodologies may or may not be able to do that with a degree of accuracy. And then also you have the regulatory tailwinds in our space, which I think are quite unique. You have a building industry that's, as I said, very conservative, but under huge pressure from governments, from carbon legislations as well. And it's becoming a financial penalty for them. So a number of the biggest companies in the concrete and cement, well, particularly cement sector, but also the concrete sector, they're essentially paying, almost a tax on top of how much cement they use. So to listeners, they may have heard of EU ETS, the Emission Trading Scheme. There's a similar scheme being enrolled in the UK now. But essentially what this is, to make it very simple, is almost like a VAT on top of how much cement you're allowed to use and produce and implement. So, and the issue with ETS and potentially other carbon taxes, it's driving the cost of concrete and cement up almost exponentially. Like there's various forecasts actually which are showing that the price of cement is going to go up by like 50% in the next 5 years. And for a low margin commodity, that's not great. there's kind of almost acceptance or this kind of thinking in the industry that people, the end user, the end client, is just going to accept this. And it's a bit weird to me, if I'm being honest. So, you know, especially for built environments, we want, you know, really clean, as we said on the topic of sustainability, sustainable built environments that are well built, as decarbonized as possible, have, you know, as minimal embodied carbon as possible, but fundamentally at a price that is affordable as well. Because if the price is 100x above what's already been done, then unfortunately we can't do that unless, you know, you find the money from somewhere to fund that. But in most cases you can't, right? It has to be, as you said, quite rightly said earlier, there has to be a business case to that. And thankfully with our case, even though it's still early stage, we're the only company in our area of carbon sequestration of concrete that can make concrete cheaper, because in our case as well, we're not going to be a manufacturer per se of concrete or a manufacturer of our carrier material. We want to work with our customers, in this case, concrete and cement manufacturers, and then license the technology to them. And then with the benefits that we can bring from a cost savings perspective and emissions reduction perspective, we share in that benefit. So essentially we're trying to co-create value with the industry. Like the infrastructure for creating concrete is already there. It's already well established. There's no need to change it. There's no need to reinvent the wheel from that perspective, but there's a fundamental lack of innovation in how to actually decarbonize this infrastructure. And we believe that we can, with our technology, we can go some way to doing that, particularly from the case of carbon sequestration. There's a number of layered benefits. And I think, as you quite rightly said, it's really important that we continue to build on that and continue to make that a fundamental part of what we're doing. Because, again, particularly in construction and concrete, it's very cost driven. And as I'm sure the same in other industries with a sustainability focus. So, you know, having said that, if you do have a technology that is quite expensive in the short term, or, you know, in its nascent stages is quite expensive, it's not necessarily the end of the world. It's about how you can drive that cost down so that adoption can increase, particularly if the emission or the sustainability benefits are there. But thankfully, in our case, given our model is licensing, we can really champion those benefits kind of really at the early stage. It's an exciting time for us. There's lots of potential there, but there are some almost weird push-pull dynamics as well, because then, I guess, just to finish up on this point, there are regulatory, not necessarily concerns, but regulatory factors that we have to bear in mind. New technologies like ours go through a process, particularly for public projects or public applications of building materials. There is a process of approval that has to go through. I'm sure we should be fine, because we're working with a number of people in that space, which are really helping us. But But there's that's another kind of dynamic in our field, which affects the rate at which not just technologies like ours, but other technologies can come into the space and make a difference from a sustainability perspective in particular. So yeah, it's a very, very cool dynamic, and very, when you get into it, there's lots of moving elements actually. Like you, as someone who wasn't a concrete person a year ago, and obviously almost like a quasi expert now, having gone deep into it, there's so many moving elements which make it quite fascinating. And yeah, you think concrete's quite a boring material, but in fact it's not. Maybe that's just me being biased.
But I think it's interesting that you use the phrase, and it was amazing that you did use it, because it is something, you know, I've been sort of passionately pushing along with others in recent years. But this co-creation of value. So you said it. These are your words: co-creation of value. And I want everybody listening to this to really just stop and think for a moment, because if you've got the next great idea, like Dalraj has, and kind of you want to kind of move this thing forward, and it's not just about you. I think this is the key point coming through here, is that you have to have those relationships. And when you talk there about, you know, working with the regulators, and, you know, you might not be thinking about sort of breaking into, if you're an entrepreneur or want to be an entrepreneur, and you're not necessarily thinking about breaking into a particularly heavily regulated industry, there are still influencers, there are still industry associations, there are still kind of, you know, important third parties who you have to get on board. You cannot do this in isolation. And certainly, you know, when it comes to regulation, things like that, have you found that as you've had those conversations, the innovation, because there is a big, big sustainability hook, do you find those conversations are maybe a little more smooth nowadays, or a little bit more easier to kind of broach that conversation because you've got the sustainability hook in there? I mean, if you were coming up with something that was, you know, technologically incredible, but actually it was going to trash the planet, that would probably be very hard to go to the regulator with, wouldn't it? I mean, is sustainability now almost something you can trade on?
Yeah, very much so. Particularly in our space, in building materials, in concrete, in construction. Particularly for, like, if you go up the value chain and you go up towards like end clients and developers and contractors, they're very strict, I guess, particularly in the public sector, but even in the private sector, there's particularly strict targets on embodied carbon and reducing embodied carbon. And actually, end clients paying a premium for methods of construction which are lower in embodied carbon and create, I guess the term is used, green buildings, but, you know, the point being, you know, buildings that are built in the most decarbonized way possible, in the most sustainable way possible. So it's, as you can tell, it's becoming a financial penalty for companies who are not being sustainable or as sustainable as they can be. And so, yeah, it's very much a key consideration in our industry now, and it's probably, this is the point by which it's starting to take off in that sense. Whereas I'd say probably 10 years ago, it probably wasn't the case. People were talking about it, and they were concerned. I wouldn't say they weren't concerned, but the financial penalty wasn't there, and now it's here. And, you know, net zero is such a hot topic across all industry verticals, and it's a fundamental, almost decision factor. Like, you have all these decision factors associated with the project or associated with the work stream, and now embodied carbon in the construction sector in particular is one of the key factors that's always at top of mind. And luckily enough, we fit right into that and speak right to that point, as well as a more financial point. So yeah, we've had really good conversations, and we've got really good feedback and buy-in from regulators and all stakeholders, to be fair. And I think it's important to do that, because you need to, especially for startups like ours and other startups in climate tech, you need to legitimize your presence in the market. What I mean by that is, you may or may not have a solution out in the market right now. And I guess in our case, we don't. We're still at the prototyping stage, still working with a number of partners, both industry and regulatory, to work together and, as I say, co-create that value and bring our technology to market. In doing that, we're legitimizing our presence, right? Through association with these industry players, with regulators, that creates value, or creates, you know, an equity in our brand, in our company, that people can get behind, that people can trust, right? Because if you're just a company that shouts on the rooftops that something needs to be done, then the people that can help you get the thing done don't believe in you or don't buy into you, then there may be a problem there. So I think particularly in our sector, I guess I can only speak to that in great depth, is there needs to be a collaborative approach to the problem that's facing us. Maybe in other sectors you can almost do it in a more singular fashion to some extent, potentially if it's more B2C focused, but particularly in our sector, there's multiple players in the value chain that need to be factored in and need to be part of the round table discussion in particular. And then that will then affect how we go to market, how we interact with certain players at certain times, because at some point in our journey, they'll be really helpful for us in legitimizing our presence and helping us achieve what we want to achieve, because that will then help them as well. So there's this trade-off of value, right? And things coming together and meshing together at the right times for things to then get completed. And it's important to recognize that and create those relationships early, be frank with people that say, look, what we're developing is very novel, very new. There's maybe some technical challenges associated with that, but with collaborative effort, with insight from those parties, with even help from those parties or resources from those parties where possible, we can de-risk that journey forward and create benefits for everybody. And essentially that's what we're trying to do. Because if you can do that, you can create massive value that everybody can share it. So that's quite cool about what we're doing, actually, is we're creating this value with a number of partners and doing it in a way which hopefully will have lots of benefits going forwards.
And it's, to me, this practicality here, that this is not just about a bunch of wannabe entrepreneurs, you know, brandishing around all these lovely ideas and saying, oh, this time next year I'm going to be a billionaire kind of thing. This is kind of like grassroots down, getting your hands dirty with doing the hard work, forging those relationships, making, you know, it's practicality. I mean, there is the word, and it's in a nutshell, isn't it? So when it comes to kind of the big dream, the big vision, I mean, what you're talking about here, and particularly through, and I think this is a really cunning plan, the whole licensing model that you're going here, you're not looking to become a concrete company. You're not looking to become a cement company. You're working to your skill set with the technologies and licensing. And again, the reason I'm kind of re-emphasizing that to the audience listening here is that that's important. You don't have to take on an established industry. You can work collaboratively doing your piece and potentially become super, super successful, you know, because this is interesting, because then when it comes to this word kind of scaling, which obviously I want to touch on now, and obviously there may well be commercial sensitivities that you can't kind of give the actual details here. You can lead on this, but I'm just interested and curious as to kind of how big do you think this could be? Because from where I'm sitting and listening to this, this is global, ground-changing, literally ground-changing. You get this right, it's kind of sky's the limit, literally.
Yeah, no, very much so. It does have that potential. Because essentially with our technology, it can be applied to any territory in the world, any market in the world. Actually, we're speaking with concrete manufacturers and cement manufacturers around the world right now, and developing our technology with their ecosystem in mind. So in particular, we're looking at basically different strands of our technology and different carriers that are specifically designed for a concrete manufacturer that's, let's say, based in Thailand or based in Japan or based in the US or based in Canada. So much so that our license enables them to create the ecosystem, a local ecosystem where they can implement our technology, and it just kind of runs itself. They just take the technology and it works, as opposed to them relying on a central source. Let's say, for example, they need to get certain materials from the UK and then ship it over to the US and then do something else. That won't work, but we're going through this journey of trying to get the pieces in place whereby we get over the technical hurdles, and then if we have certain commercial pieces in place alongside that, then the global scale potential is definitely there. It's definitely there. And I think that the reason why it's there as well is because we've identified the gap whereby there's a specific problem which the concrete industry is not solving. And then we have the skill set to solve that gap and then obviously generate value as a result of that. I think what can happen is that you potentially, companies don't necessarily, they think there's a gap there, but there's not actually a gap there, and therefore the opportunity isn't there. But in our case, we've identified, I think, the gap of R&D and innovation in the sense of decarbonisation and carbon sequestration in concrete is there. It's still one of the, I'd say, more nascent, niches within concrete. I think it's according to all the kind of industry papers and kind of data sources that we've come across, it's set to grow exponentially over the next 10 to 20 years. So, even if it is a small, I guess, relatively small market now, it's going to be a hot market very, very soon. We're kind of almost going with that and kind of going along the journey with that and trying to be the foremost company in that space. So the potential is very vast. It's very fast. But I'm very, practical is a good word of thinking about. I try to be quite pragmatic and take it one step at a time, because fundamentally for me, I want this to work and bring benefits to customers first and foremost, the first customer or the second customer. If it doesn't work for the first customer, it's not going to work for the 100th customer. So in making sure that we de-risk those elements, getting that feedback from our end partners, from our customers, and incorporating that into our technology development cycle is really, really important. And that will then hopefully feed into the development of what we're doing, maybe, solve some unknown unknowns that can occur, certain challenges that you may not have forecasted that come up because you're working in a collaborative manner. And then hopefully then that can provide the foundation for global scalability. The final point to make is, I think with our technology is we are applicable to all types of concrete. So other solutions in our space, within carbon sequestration in concrete, have limitations as to the types of concrete they can work with, or the type of concrete application, I should say. Whereas with our process, there's no limitation in that sense. We can work with 100% of all the applications of concrete, whether that's concrete that's used in a pavement, concrete that's used in a building, concrete that's used in a bridge, anything. And so that opens up the whole market. So having even just a very negligible part of that market, according to our forecasts, even if we had 0.2% of the UK and EU market, we'd be absolutely fine. But at the same time, it's one thing saying that, another thing doing that. And we're very conscious of that and making sure that we get to that level step by step. The potential is very much there and it's very exciting. And hopefully, fingers crossed, if we keep on our path and keep ticking off our milestones as we have done so far, then hopefully we can get there.
So for a chief commercial officer to spend 3/4 of an hour guiding and advising us without actually talking about the numbers, this is what I call refreshing. Because, when you're talking about market gaps, filling needs and co-creating value, this is what we should be discussing. This is kind of building a real business. And I think there's so many people, and hopefully, a few listening to this and now kind of making their little checklist with all the wise guidance that Dalraj is imparting to us here, who are actually going to rethink actually what it really means to be a startup, what it means to be an entrepreneur, what it means to be, trying to kind of innovate and create new value for the world. The money will follow. The money will come later if you do the right thing. And I just find it so refreshing. And I'm not just saying this. I think, genuinely, this is so exciting, the fact that you're talking about all these kind of really added value, practical things, and really not worrying too much about the money, because the money is going to happen. If you can tick all these boxes and answer all these challenges, the market's there because you've profiled it, and that the relationships are there because you've already started fostering them. It feels like you're doing things the right way round. Why do you think it is that too many people kind of chase the dollar signs rather than actually kind of do this properly?
That's a good question. I guess money is very, it's a very interesting topic, isn't it? It's very attractive, very alluring. And of course, money is a great incentive. It's the same incentive for us. But at the same time, I like to think about it in terms of value. The amount of money you generate is directly proportional to the amount of value you can create and the number of problems you can solve. In our case, we seem to be solving a big problem which can have massive value and therefore has great financial potential. If people can be very pragmatic and logical about that, equation for their context, then they can see if they can create some level of value, then there will be a financial opportunity. But ultimately, in the early stages, it's not very profitable at all. Like for a long period of time, we haven't been paying ourselves a salary. We've been working for free, working very long hours. Can be quite stressful. At the same time, the point being is we're doing it because there's a purpose behind it. There's an inherent value in doing this. And we're solving a big problem that needs to be solved. Someone has to solve it, so why not us? And that's the fundamental driver. And if that's not the fundamental driver for someone else looking to buy and build a company, then it may or may not be the right thing for them to do to build that company. Not to say that it's wrong to be money-minded or anything. That's totally up to that individual person. But I can only speak for myself and my team. We're fully focused on what we're trying to solve here, and looking to do it in the best way possible, in a way which has maximum value and create maximum impact. And the rest will take care of itself. And just try to keep it as simple as that, really. I think it's good to have good targets as to, let's say, the amount of revenue you'd like to generate by certain time periods, for example. But again, it's important not to put too much weight into that, because things will change over time. There'll be challenges that pop up that may change course. You may need to pivot your business. We may need to pivot, actually. We have to stay agile in that aspect until you're a fully established revenue generating company. There will be certain decisions or certain pivots you may or may not have to make. So having that level of flexibility and not being so tied to a monetary figure that's tied down to a certain way of you building the company, which is based on a certain idea, then you're kind of liable to that, right? So having a different grounding to say, okay, we've got this problem to solve. We have a base idea that has potential. We're going to work on that. Try to de-risk all the elements of it, all the elements associated with it, create as much value as we can from that particular way of working and that method and that solution. And hopefully that will yield benefits. It should yield benefits. So yeah, it's tricky because, we're all entrepreneurs because we want to make money, quite frankly, but that's kind of, as I say, that's directly tied to the amount of value that we want to create, right? So that's how I like to think about it. And perhaps maybe, hopefully that message resonates with others is, rather than think about it in terms of money, think about it in terms of how much value you can generate. If you can generate unique value that you can't find elsewhere, then I'm sure you get remunerated, quite nicely.
The money follows, definitely. So 10 years time, we'll actually now bring it back before that. So let's say 2030, 8 years time. Dalraj, what is Dalraj? Where is Dalraj? Kind of what is the future? 2030, what are you doing? Where are you?
That's a good question. I think fundamentally just to be content and happy with what I'm doing. At the minute, I try to keep it as personal, as simple as possible. I think if I'm, just try to be doing something that's progressive, that's, as I say, solving a problem that's feeding into something that's, has a wider benefit. And hopefully that will be, our plan is for that to be with Concrete for Change. And hopefully by that time I'm not saying we're not established, but really like fully established in the space and it ticked off a lot of the boxes that will need to be alive by 2030 as well. That would be that'll be a really cool achievement if we could do that and really be a real established presence in the space that we want to be in. But fundamentally, for me, I think it'd just be a case of continuing my own personal journey, doing something that's really, really powerful, which I think we're doing something that's really powerful and unique and valuable. And then hopefully in that period of time, I'd have helped others as well in contributing to that journey or, contributing to their own journeys, whether they want to build their own businesses or create impact and sustainability elsewhere. Because I think that's really important that we do that. I think it's important that we try to inspire people to do what they can and extrapolate their own potential as well, because I think there's a lot of potential there. There's a lot of untapped potential, even probably myself as well, and continue to strive to improve and continue to improve over time. That will hopefully yield benefits. I'd say to cap it off, hopefully we're a unicorn, if you will, but I'm not particularly putting too much weight on that. I think it's a case of just pushing, hopefully keeping the company going and being as valuable as possible to the industry, and taking it from there, and hopefully we reduce the emissions impact of the industry as well, the concrete industry. That's the key target. If we can do that, then I hope everything takes care of itself, which I'm sure it would.
So everybody listening to this, if you're still listening to this, this is what an entrepreneur sounds like, by the way. Thought I'd just add that in there. This is a real entrepreneur, okay? Not somebody who just would like to be. This is actually what it sounds like to be a real one. How would people contact you, Dharaj? Because obviously, still being in the R&D phase, as you described it, Concrete for Change isn't actually commercial right here, right now. So I know, understand the website is coming soon. But if there are people on here who would like to connect with you, how should they go about doing that?
Sure. People are more than welcome to contact me via LinkedIn. So if you just type in my name, Dharaj Nijjar, so D-A-L-R-A-J, my first name and second name, N-I-J-J-A-R. Type that on LinkedIn and then feel free to connect with me on there. And then similarly, you can contact me via email. Hopefully Neil can include this on the video version and also in the podcast notes as well. Feel free to contact me via email or LinkedIn, and be more than happy to connect with you guys, discuss, work together, and take things forward from there. It'd be great to connect with everybody.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for your time, Dharaj. It's just been really, really great to talk to, I guess I would say, a like-minded soul. You're more entrepreneurial than me, but I've got that same mindset. When you say co-create value, it's just like, oh yeah, it's my kind of guy. So it's been really, really great talking to you. It's been real pleasure. So thank you for your time and all your wise advice to those listening. It's been really much appreciated.
No worries, Neil. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.